this a war. A tribulation war. A every nation war. Yes, it's a global war. Yeah. In a this a war. A tribulation war. A every nation war. Yes, it's a global war. Yeah. You would have just war. It's a mystical war. Yes, it's a biblical war. And it's a global war.
Funky revolutions, funky.
Funky revolutions, funky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Funky revolutions,
whoa,
funky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Funky revolutions, funky. You are listening to Funky Revolutions.
Funky revolutions.
Ghetto music. We think of Joe Higgs as the first Trenchtown artist.
Music originated from the confrontation of the struggle. So the roots really is from a matter of struggle. That's where it's from. It's not even good to be known that you are from Trenchtown. This is the kind of strength that you have to really accumulate.
Reggae is a confrontation of sound, man. Reggae has to have that basic, vibrant sound, which is to be heard in a ghetto is like playing the bass very loud and the drum. You know, those are the basic sounds.
A classical reggae should be accepted in a part of the world in the same sense. Freedom. That's what it's asking for. Acceptance. That's what it needs. And understanding, you know. What reggae is saying.
I
The Upsetter, from Lee Scratch Perry. Sung and written by Perry, it was one of the last songs he would do with Joe Gibbs, the producer, even at a time where he had begun to strike out on his own after a series of collaborations and an evolution in the musical culture of Jamaica, starting in 1960 when he arrived in Kingston. Before that, we heard on Funky Revolutions Joe Higgs speaking about the essence of reggae music and echoing some of the words that from Lee Perry and ideas of Lee Perry we heard at the beginning of our homage a couple of weeks ago. This is part two, the early years of Lee Scratch Perry, as we begin looking at first his evolution, his introduction into the musical circles of Kingston, Jamaica, and his own work as he attempted to become a singer before becoming a producer in the late 60s. I'm indebted, among other things, to the authorized biography by David Katz, People Funny Boy, The Genius of Lee Scratch Perry, and featured again today in our series, a conversation with Montreal's own Mossman, longtime collaborator on Funky Revolutions, as we look at kind of that beginning period and a short history of the career of Lee Scratch Perry to set us up in the next few weeks into the golden years of the 1970s before he would burn down the Black Ark Studios in 1979. We start with I Am the Upsetter, that double-edged philosophy he described a couple of weeks ago, and really an upsetting man in terms of upsetting customs, upsetting collaborators, but really contributing to the evolution of reggae music. And some of his songs, like People Funny Boy, are credited with being some of the first really transition period from rocksteady to reggae music, that early sound, as he was then also collaborating, for example, with the Wailers, helping them develop their sound that would launch them in the early 70s to international fame. He was born in Kendall, Jamaica, small village, to a very poor family who were cane cutters. And he was set on not living that life, would leave school around 14, 15 years old, and concentrate first on trying to make money as a domino champion player. And then one of the things he was really known for was his dance and his ability to do a number of really crazy dances. And he would travel around Clarendon two championships and begin really making a name for himself in that sense. And it was that also helped him attract attention to himself and the way he was integrated into sound systems when he would arrive in Jamaica. A turning point for him would be in the late 50s, having looked at how people drove tractors. When Negril was being opened up as a tourist attraction, he would get a job working as a heavy machinery road builder, even though he didn't have the qualifications. And he would describe that period as being fundamental to his understanding of sound, as he heard the explosions and crackling of rocks. And within those stones, some of the sounds and rock sounds that would influence his approach to music. And within it, he describes in his in the biography and in a couple of interviews how that was that natural sound would influence him and call him and push him, among other things, to go to Kingston to try and find a career in the music business. His work really it can be punctuated in three times with the important sound systems of the day as he began to collaborate and to hang around these sound systems that were kind of the second, if not the third generation of the sound systems, and marked the transition from these sound systems playing American records, soul, rhythm and blues, jazz, basically, you know, outdoor parties to bring people together. I'm talking first about Duke Reed, who had, through his former policeman, who through his tough ways and his ability to use violence, really put aside the second generation of the important sound systems and began to dominate the scenes. It's also a time where not only has the West Indian sounds, Jamaican sounds from Buru music and Mento begun to influence the production and sounds and in the way the Jamaicans were making popular music and evolving their sounds leading into ska in the early 60s, but it was really a time where they began to put out their own records, influenced by the success of recordings made of, for example, Mento music, its release on Smithsonian Records. The sound systems would begin to record their own sounds with local singers, moving away just from simple R&B, soul jazz records type of recordings that had already begun to be influenced and integrate the vibes and influences locally, and but also, you know, sounds from the Dominican Republic, the calypso sounds. And as this sound begins to evolve, the ska element is becoming evident in the early 1960s, and this is a time at which Lee Scratch Perry begins to integrate the sounds. He moves to Kingston, Jamaica, and like many Clarendonians with no money, basically floor surfs, spending time on the floors of a tailor shop, and attracts the attention of Duke Reed. And the not an errand boy, but he would go and sell records, live records. He would spy on sounds to see what the latest sounds records were, what was a hit with the crowds. And that would became an evident skill that he had, was to hear the hits or to be able to spot singers before they were well known and understand what would please a crowd. He would evolve then into beginning to songwrite because he wanted to sing. And there was very much resistance to his voice and his skills. And it would take a bit of time before he could start recording records in 1962, 63, 64, 65. And then began to arrange music, working among others with Jackie Mitu on arrangements. He would learn how to play the drums, recording on percussion sessions. And then eventually in around 1966, begin producing with Cox and Dodd and the early days of Studio One. So he moves from Duke Reed at a period where he is not being able to record, but the kind of cataclysmic event between him and Duke Reed is Lee Perry's reproach that one of his songs, Rough and Tough, will be given without his permission to Stranger Cole and has a bit of success. From the conflict and actual physical fight or beatdown he receives from Duke Reed, he moves over and is taken under the wing of Cox and Dodd, who is an important player and where his role really begins to evolve in these ways that I've just described. He'll have a breakup around 1966 with Cox and Dodd as he's beginning to produce and move over to the Joe Gibbs and Prince Buster camps before about 1968, doing independent work and then collaborating with WIRL producers, creating the Upset label, and then moving on in around 69 to create the Upsetter label that was so fundamental to the development of reggae music and contributing to its evolution. We're going to try and look around that period that leads up to his own production work, his signature sounds, and that evolution into reggae music. We begin first, though, with that song that created the riff between him and Duke Reed and moves him into the Cox and Dodd camp. This is Stranger Cole with Lee Perry's Rough and Tough.
Who are you that I should be mindful of? You run for refuge and were rescued, that's a fact. Then why lie and try to bite the hand that feed you? Yes, the good you do lives after you. You could puff, puff and puff till you bust. It shall be rough, rough and tough on your side. So stop lying, don't try to bite the hands that feed you. For the good you do lives after you.
Listening to Funky Revolutions with myself, Khalid, on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Part two of our tribute to Lee Scratch Perry. The early years. His first released recording was in 1963 with Cox and Dodd. And it's there that with this track, first as an acetate played only at the dances, and then a very, very popular, released in a limited series and ways, that he would get the scratch part of his name. It was a dance, and he was such a great dancer, he eulogized it in this song, Chicken Scratch. He was called Little Lee, and then Chicken Scratch. It was the scratch part that would stick, and to the man that we know now as Lee Scratch Perry, from 1963, his first release and success.
Hello, guy in dirt black and blue tie. Why you looking so sad? Tell me why. Grab a skirt. Chicken scratch. All night long, standing there, looking sad. Grab a skirt, jump around like you're mad.
Taku, produced by Clement Dodd and or Coxon and Rainford Perry, otherwise known as Lee Scratch Perry. Taku. A couple of more from 1965, a couple of more songs from this period that really shows the evolution and heart of music. And if you go back and read, for example, Pretty Funny Boy and other histories of Jamaican music in this period in the 1960s that is so fruitful and leads us into reggae music, the ska, the rock steady, so many of these initial musicians were, there was this core of musicians. There was a few recording studios, Federal, WIRL, a couple of others that emerged, that the different competing sound systems and labels that under these sound systems were often in the same studios at different, crossing over each other. And many of these musicians were fundamental to the recordings themselves, not the entire scene, but, you know, 30 or 4 musicians' names come up, like Tommy McCook or Jackie Mito, among others. And it's fascinating, the collaborations and the continuity over 20, 30 years, how these musicians, for example, the guitarist Ernest Ranglin, coming from rhythm and blues and jazz in the 50s right through until classic reggae periods and being part of the Upsetters. But they played with various various collaborators and various permutations. From Taku, we stick to 1965, and we're going to hear, among others, we're going to hear, well, first a track that he performed with the Soulettes, which was actually featured, among others, Rita Marley, a trio that backed him up on By St. Peter. And then we get to see some music also from the same period. And in this time period, I mean, he's working basically with what will become the Scatolites, musicians like Jackie Mito and others like that. From there we go to Roast Duck featuring the Dynamites, again, a pivotal group and whose members would be essential to the various sounds and permutations of reggae music later on. And then we also get to hear, well, we'll get back to that, a song with the Wailers and Hand to Hand. On CKUT 90.3 FM, our tribute to the early years of Lee Scratch Perry.
Bye. We've never met, and to be honest, we probably never will. That's not really important. But there are probably people out there who are important to you, who are reluctant to get the COVID-19 vaccine for themselves and for their children. We all have our reasons, but if we take the time to listen to others, we can help reassure and support them, and that's really important.
The first step to understanding is listening. If you have questions about the vaccines, visit quebec.ca/vaccine talk, a message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
Trim them down to size.
We shall defeat them one by one.
Hand to hand, man to man.
We shall defeat them one by one.
If they set a trap, it shall fall back in your lap.
We shall defeat them one by one.
Hand to hand from the Scratch Perry, backed by the Wailers. This period of 1965 is really ska's evolution into rock steady. I thought we'd play a couple of more tracks, respectively recorded, all produced by Cox and Dodd. This period where he's going to become a producer, Lee Scratch Perry, that is, and as he begins to move away from Cox and Dodd. But we'll start with 64, Solid as a Rock, and then a track featuring the Gay Lads, Run, Rudy, Run. Before we begin talking with Moss Man about how this period fits into the evolution of Lee Scratch Perry's career. On CKUT 90.3 FM, this is Funky Revolutions.
Oh, Was the beginning of the career of learning the ropes of the industry, of singing, songwriting, arranging, beginning him to learn percussion, found sounds, beginning of mixing. It's all the beginning elements, you know. It's proto dub. There's dubs being half mixed and stuff, but they didn't have echo and reverb. They were maybe only the mixing board itself being really utilized as the actual, as one of the tools or the ZFX, you know. So it's the beginning part of that. And he had a really strong hand. A lot of people give credit to his people, Funny Boys, one of being one of those first reggae songs. And so from the very beginning, when he started producing stuff on his own label, experimental, found sounds, crashing noises, babies crying, you know, the new type of rhythm, this whole kind of interjection, singing, toasting, all these things all merged together and all layered. The arrangement of like four or five guitars, you know, of all this layering of music and getting the musicians to play the best and most soulful and groovy they possibly could on the tracks. And that kind of Wallace soundy kind of thing was very much there. And then just transition into more minimalist and then back into this whole other new type of kind of wall of sound production, which is much more experimental, you know, using weird phasers and this and that. So he just loved the process, and he loved to try and make things as better as they could, and was able to coax that out of a lot of the musicians. He wasn't able to specifically say these things. He didn't know, have any knowledge. Okay, go into a dissident, you know, I want you now to go like, you know, he couldn't explain arranging to songs. He could sing it, but he couldn't explain it in terminology. Like, okay, F minor, bridge to C minor, then I want a descending, you know, like a horn line with the crescendo. He couldn't do that. He didn't have that knowledge to be able to communicate in that respect. But in the way that he did know, he did. In the way, you know, he would sing it, or he would, you know, communicate in whatever different ways. And sometimes it was just him vibing out. You know, I've spoken to him. Sometimes it's just him in the studio having fun, dancing around, coming up, just bouncing off ideas. And sometimes that's all it needs, you know. Within the process of a studio recording session, it needs to be fun. It needs to be adventure. It needs to be this energy has to be in this room. And Scratch brought that energy for sure. He was that kind of guy. Because when you're with someone that loves the creative process and loves trying different things, obviously it's gonna affect the other people in the room, be it singers or musicians and that kind of stuff. And Perry, if there was anything that Perry, I don't think if there was anything more than maybe, I don't know, but one of probably the most thing he loved the most was the creative process and living in it, being it, you know, the living art.
Talk a little bit about the Upsetters, like as conductor, as producer, as...
Well, that would have started in around the late 60s, so some of these musicians already knew of him from the work he was doing with Joe Gibbs and Coxon and these other studios, kind of working, helping, writing, arranging different little things in there. And then from that point on, him starting his own label, it just grew, and all those original, all those musicians, they were always happy to come and work with him because they knew it was going to be something different. It's going to be fun. It's going to be different. And regardless of the money situation, I guess, they just were wanting to have fun and be part of that process because they knew going with Scratch that it's an adventure. You don't know what's going to happen. You know what song's going to... And by 70, 71, by the early, he's already had a bunch of hit songs. They just knew that it was something different, very different compared to all the other studios in Jamaica.
And the Black Ark studio, that when did he burn that down the first time?
79.
79? Okay. So that golden period of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
How did he evolve in that sound? Because you have all the classic records from Max Romeo and the Upsetters.
It's pretty minimalist in the beginning. So in the, you have to think about the 70 to 75 in Jamaica. The sound was roots reggae and lovers rock and very much rootsy, though, kind of stuff. And quite minimal. You know, the sound, the big influence of that time most was like someone like King Tubby started mixing the vocals of singers and making them more minimal and really accentuating the drum and bass and, you know, catering to how the sound is going to be in a sound system. So how people are going to listen to this on those big speaker boxes and this and that. And by 75, 76, Scratch had a whole bunch of other hits, you know, new hits, Curly Locks and a few others coming out of the studio, and it was already a buzz, already kind of a mystical kind of thing going on, like interesting stuff happening, and then it just kind of escalated from there. Now, did Jamaicans think it was crazy? Yes. So from that phase-shifted experimental point, that stuff wasn't huge in Jamaica. Jamaicans, there was a few songs that kind of became hits for sure, Police and Thieves and War in the Babylon, you know, there's a handful of songs. But for most Jamaicans, they were just like, what is this weird stuff going on here? What is this fluorescent green milk you want me to drink?
Was that partly the sound or partly the myth of the man who would walk?
It was the sound itself. Yeah. It was unorthodox, experimental. It was hard for people to grasp. Even in the rest of the world, for people that were musicians and engineers, they loved it. For people that have a deep understanding of engineering and mixing and found sounds and all these things, yes, you know, for me, very educational. The people of the two or three engineers that taught me the most without ever actually working with them, but just paying attention and listening to them, Scientist, Scratch, and Tubby for sure. But that's coming from somebody that was wanting to, and you know, study it and learn about it and understand what was going on and how to kind of continue on within that legacy. For other people, for everybody else, it's not so much. That wasn't really so much a thing. Later on, it did. Obviously, it did once the '90s came around and jungle and trip hop and all these other kinds of forms of much more experimental, beat oriented music. Up until now, you know, now it's a different scenario. Now people like, yes, now, you know, now there's like, yes, he's seen as like very, very important, very influential. So it's just unfortunate that it took so long because it did contribute to him having a whole mental breakdown and, you know, just turning into a wreck because it was just... He didn't get it. People outside of Jamaica, not that many really knew, kind of like did, but it was like people in the world of like heavy metal and rock, and like it was just like something very much removed of what he would have liked. He would have loved to have, like, you know, continued on in Jamaica, I'm sure, done doing that thing, but people just there were just like, nah. And then there was a, it just was like, it was, as it got weirder and more experimental, he was just, he was getting more underground and more, you know, eccentric, and people just were like, okay, this is...
Eccentric's a good word.
Quite eccentric. Yeah.
The, like that whole Super Ape period.
Yes. Well, the Super Ape, that was the element of those Island Records, the major label release, and then that's what brought, as it got more experimental and stuff, it became not commercially viable, and that's where the major, Chris Blackwell, started refusing that stuff. And you know what? If you listen to that stuff now, you understand why Blackwell refused that, because it wasn't going to sell like hundreds of thousands of units like the other albums, that like Police and Thieves and Warren About. It wasn't going, it, you know, it was just out there, super out there. And it wasn't just that. There's another element of that too. There was his wife leaving him. There was like these kind of gangster scammers coming around for protection money. And then there was the ultimate breakdown, you know, it's quite sad, is the Congos, Heart of the Congos album, in which Chris Blackwell, in order to protect Bob Marley, took it, was coaching Perry the whole time, listening to the album, got him to remix it a second time, record, you know, trying to get the best thing, you know, and give him the money. I don't know how much he gave him, 40, 50 grand, bought the thing, and then put it on a shelf to not mess with Bob. He didn't want it to compete with Bob Marley. So here is his whole, the magnum opus, this whole thing that led up to his career, his pinnacle album. And the one guy that could bust it big and bring it, took it, paid whatever X amount of dollars, put it on the shelf.
When did it actually finally get out?
It came out a year later, so on a GoFeed or whatever, the Specials label, you know, those guys, the ska, but UK ska two-tone guys help. But, you know, the Specials little GoFeed little independent label out of England, that ain't Island Records. That's not Island Records major label release.
And you say that that was to protect the popularity and market share of Bob Marley.
Yes.
He had worked with the Wailers early on, no?
Yes, he had. He'd helped transition them, actually, vocally in their sound. He got Peter and Bunny to kind of like do three-part harmonies, got Peter to start doing more baritone, you know, make it beautiful, beautiful stuff. So he'd had a history with them and recorded about 20 songs in the early 70s, and that helped to get the Wailers actually signed. When Chris Blackwell heard those Lee Perry, Bob Marley productions, it convinced Bob, yes, okay, these guys are amazing, we need to sign it, and that's what happened. Now, that was that, you know, that was in the early 70s, and they transitioned into that and became megastars. That did not affect, you know, Perry wasn't a touring vocalist or anything at that point. I don't think he did. He may have not have done a single show, as far as I know, during the 70s, the entire time. I don't think he did one live performance. So, to, you know, for who he was and the type of artist he was and the way he operated, it was just, it just didn't, that's one, not what it was. It wasn't meant to be. And unfortunately, it led to his kind of mental breakdown. You know? We'll be right back.
come with our culture.
Congos with an alternate mix of Congo Man. That album, whose shelving, part of the Congos, was so destructive to the mind state of Lee Scratch Perry. Our part two today, our tribute to him, the early recordings of Lee Scratch Perry as a singer. Join us next week as we look at the early days of his production from about 1966 to the early 1970s and the establishment of reggae music in Jamaica, his influence and contribution to that evolution from rocksteady on. I was Khalid on Funky Revolutions, reminding you as usual, free your mind, our collective ass will follow.
You need a fight, you better get uptight, and don't be a square. 'Cause it's warfare.
Time.
C. C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Camp.
C. Wait. Sandro. C. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
every Saturday from 4 to 7 p.m. I listen to the West Indian Rhythm on CKUT 90.3 FM with the one and only Awad Street.